This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning. Welcome to Science Saturday. So today I would like to introduce Dr. Katja Lamia. Katja started her lab around 7 years ago, but she didn't always know she wanted to be a professor. She always liked science, but also liked dance. She went to UC Berkeley for her undergrad, and there she wanted to be a dance major. However, eventually, she changed to a physics major and went down the road to science. So Katja is an example of how mindsets can change, and you don't always necessarily have to have a major in mind when you enter college, and you can pursue what you want and change your mind about it. Katja pursued science in many different ways before getting to where she is today. She first worked with Dr. Lowy, the inventor of Gardasil, the cervical cancer vaccine, and many other places, and then went to do her PhD at Harvard. When she was finishing her PhD at Harvard, she worked at a pharmaceutical company part-time and also taught med school in Nepal. She did her postdoctoral work at Harvard and Salk just down the road, and then the rest is history. She's been awarded the Searle Scholar and the Sydney Kimmel Scholar. So without further ado, Katja will now tell us about the lab's research relating to circadian rhythms.
So good morning, everyone, and thank you, Alana, for that very kind introduction. It's a great pleasure and privilege for me to be here today and tell you about some of the work that we do and also some kind of history and background in the field of circadian biology. I'll have a lot of time for questions at the end, and I'm hoping that you can to try to convey to you some of the excitement that I feel about the research that we do and sort of the fun that we have doing it here at Scripps. So I'm going to be talking about circadian rhythms, which is basically the idea that inside your body there's a clock that keeps track of the time of day and some of the things that that regulates that you may or may not be aware of. And the way that I like to think of this, one of the reasons that I got excited about this was this concept of homeostasis that was first developed by a French physiologist in the 19th century, Claude Bernard. And he coined the term homeostasis to conceptualize the idea that maintaining a constant internal environment is beneficial for health. And one of the reasons why I got excited about circadian biology in that context is that you can imagine that changes in the environment present a challenge to homeostasis. So every point on the Earth's surface, as it turns, is exposed to daily rhythms in light, temperature, moisture, all aspects of the physical environment that are going to be influenced by the distance from the sun. And so these daily rhythms present a challenge to homeostasis, but they're also predictable. So having the ability to predict, to keep track of the time of day, allows organisms to sort of optimize their physiology in preparation for these predictable daily changes. So I'm going to give a little bit of history of the field of circadian biology. This is a very stripped down version, but hopefully it will help you understand the rest of my talk and just understand why I got very excited about these ideas in graduate school. All right, so one of the first studies of circadian rhythms were done in plants. And like a lot of biology, they were first initiated by monks a couple hundred years ago who had a lot of time and patience and observed plants day in and day out. And one of the things that they noticed is that the plant leaves exhibited movements that allowed them to optimize the exposure to sunlight over the course of the day. So as the sun would move across the sky, the leaves of the plants would follow the movement of the sun. So at first they thought this just represented the leaves of the plant following the sun. But what they realized is when they put the plants into constant darkness, the leaves would still move, suggesting that this was sort of an internal mechanism that allowed the plant to optimize its exposure to the sun, even when it couldn't see the sun. And here I'm showing, this is a video of a sunflower plant before it's flowered, and you can see how it looks like it's kind of falling asleep at night, and then the leaves open up again actually before the sun rises. So that suggests that there's a clock inside the plant that's allowing it to anticipate the time of sunrise and maximize the exposure to sunlight even before the sun actually comes up. And this was the type of evidence that got people really start thinking about whether organisms might have internal clocks that could allow them to keep track of the time of day. And this was, plant leaf movements was a really hot topic in biology in the 19th century. Even Charles Darwin wrote a book about it, and many others did as well, and he's better known for his other discoveries, but this was really an area of intense study. But it still wasn't clear. There was a lot of debate about whether these plant leaf movements really reflected an internal timekeeping mechanism in the plants, or whether it was responding to some signal. Maybe it wasn't light, but maybe there was some other signal that people hadn't identified yet that allowed them to respond to like a magnetic force or something else that was happening at the same time as the movement of the sun. So I'm going to go into a little bit of I'm going to describe some of the evidence that eventually convinced people that there really is an internal timekeeping mechanism. And I'm also going to tell you about some other biological rhythms that are exhibited by different organisms, some of which are well understood and some of which are still mysterious, but all of which I think are very interesting. So one of the this is actually one of the people that first inspired me to get interested in circadian rhythms. His name is Woody Hastings. He passed away a couple years ago. But my first year in graduate school, when I was still kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with myself, I audited a course in circadian biology. So as Alana mentioned, I had actually studied physics in undergraduate, well, first dance and then physics. And so I was in a biophysics PhD program, and I thought that I would study something like X-ray crystallography, which is a method by which you can determine the structure of proteins. But I audited this course. I had never heard of circadian biology before, but it sounded really interesting. And it was taught by this guy, Woody Hastings. And he had actually, for decades, studied this marine organism that produces bioluminescence. And it specifically produces that bioluminescence at night. And I thought this was interesting, first of all, just because it's really beautiful. If you've ever been out by the water at night and you see the phosphorescent algae glowing in the water, it's really beautiful. And what he had shown is that that is actually governed by a circadian rhythm. So the organisms produce the light at night, and it's actually a mechanism of camouflage for them because it makes it look like the moonlight sparkling on the surface of the sea. So that tricks the predators. Anyway, so he had studied that, and he taught this course. It was really fascinating. Another reason why I found that especially interesting, I grew up, both my parents come from, I don't know what you call families that did things on the water, fishermen or boat builders. This is me with all my large family of siblings growing up. So that was another reason why I found this really fascinating. This is one of the reasons I got into this field. So I mentioned the bioluminescence. This is a camouflage mechanism for a lot of marine animals. Another rhythm that's seen in marine animals, a lot of them respond to monthly rhythms or circolunar rhythms that are actually governed by the phases of the moon and the tides. And this is something that I don't know if you may have seen. I had never heard of this before I moved to San Diego, but there's an organism that lives down in the water and spawns on the beach only at the time of high tide. So this is California grunion. There's a website put out by the Department of Fish and Wildlife that they publish every year the times of the grunion runs, and you can actually go down to the beach and see this. It's not happening now in the winter, but it'll happen in the spring and summer. And it's very specific, a few days every month at very specific times. It's only when the high tide occurs. They lay their eggs in the sand, and this basically allows the eggs to hatch and not get washed away before they hatch, and then it's timed perfectly so that when they hatch, it's the next high tide, and they get swept back out to sea. So this is just amazing to me. How can these animals predict the time of the high tide? And this is actually a biological rhythm that's not very well understood yet. There's a professor in Austria, Kristin Tesmer-Reile, who's probably one of the world's experts on this, and they still are trying to understand the mechanism. So they've done all the work now that proves that there is an internal timekeeping mechanism that allows these fish to keep track of the time of the month. and it responds to moonlight, but they don't know exactly how it works yet. So this, for me, is kind of a continuing mystery, and one of the things that I like about science is trying to understand how these things work. But so those are rhythms that happen in plants and in marine organisms, but what about in people? There are a lot of aspects of human physiology that are also influenced by the time of day. So here are just some examples. So I'm sure that one that you're very, very familiar with is a sleep-wake cycle. Of course, you're going to sleep at night and be awake during the day. And the timing of when you're most likely to be asleep and how much sleep you need is actually determined by, or at least partially determined by, genetics. But all these other functions are also affected by the time of day. So your metabolism, your mental acuity, lots of different things, your blood pressure. But so in my lab, we study mammals, and mostly we study mice, or we use mice as a tool for studying circadian rhythms in mammals. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the history of that field and some of the experiments that were done that convinced people that animals have circadian clocks that allow them to keep track of the time of day. So in mice, the circadian rhythm that is most easily measurable is their behavior. They like to run in running wheels, just like you can find at a pet store. So they're nocturnal, so they're awake at night and they run in these running wheels. And we can actually record the amount of their activity by hooking up the running wheel to a computer. And we make an electrical circuit so that every time the wheel spins, it closes this electrical circuit and produces a signal. And you can record those signals with a computer, and basically the data looks something like this, where every time the wheel spins, you get this black mark. And when the mice are sleeping, resting, not running in the wheel, there's no signal, so it looks white. And this is data from a paper back in the 1960s, and that was one of the studies that convinced people that there really is an internal timekeeping mechanism that drives these behavioral rhythms. And so, as I mentioned, mice are nocturnal, so when they're kept in a light-dark cycle with 12 hours of darkness and 12 hours of light, you see that the signal is here in the dark. They're active during the dark period, or what looks like night to them. But the important thing is that then, if they turn the lights off, so there's no more light signal, the mice continue to run in the running wheel with a period of about 24 hours, but it's slightly shorter than 24 hours. So over the course of many days, the time at which they start running in the running wheel drifts a little bit earlier every day. So it continues to have this periodic rhythm, but it's slightly different from the 24-hour day, meaning that they're going, the time at which they start to run gets a little bit earlier every day. And they could record this activity for months. So it's changing, it's getting what we call out of phase with the period of the Earth's movement. So this demonstrated that their activity rhythm really can't be responding to any signal in the environment, because any environmental signal would have a period of exactly 24 hours. So the fact that their behavior has a slightly different period and is going out of phase with that environmental cycle was one of the really important pieces of evidence that convinced people that these rhythms are driven by an internal timer that has a period of close to 24 hours, but not exactly 24 hours. So this behavior here is set by the light signal, but in the darkness there's no timing cue and it still continues. This was also around the time that one of the scientists in the field coined the term circadian. So circa means, you know, approximately, and dian, the length of a day. So these rhythms are circadian, they're about the length of a day. Other evidence that demonstrated how circadian clocks work in mammals came from neurobiologists who were trying to identify the location of the circadian clock. So where in the body does this timekeeper, where is it located? And they knew it was in the brain, and they did lesioning studies where they would use a laser to disrupt different regions of the brain and then look for effects on the behavior. And they identified a region that's located just above the optic chiasm. So the optic chiasm is the place where your optic nerves come back from your eyes. And there's a small region of your brain that's located just above those nerves that can, so it can respond to light signals coming from your eyes. And if they delete that little region, it's about 10,000 neurons, they completely abolish these circadian rhythms in behavior. And subsequent studies actually show that you can transplant the material from this region from one animal into another and influence their behavioral rhythms. Okay, so that was a lot of the evidence that demonstrated that animals have clocks that drive their rhythms and behavior and where they're located. So now, back at around that time, there was a big debate over whether behavior could be genetically influenced, genetically determined. You've probably heard debates about nature versus nurture, you know, what types of things can be driven by genes and how can that influence behavior. So Seymour Benzer is a biologist at Caltech, and he was very interested in the possibility that genes can drive behavior. And Ron Konopka was a graduate student who came to his lab. So he had just graduated from college, and he came to work with Seymour Benzer. And he said, hey, I have a great idea. When I was in college, I studied behavior in fruit flies. And we can measure their circadian rhythms of behavior. So they could use, this is data similar to what I just showed for mice. So flies don't run in wheels, but they walk around, and you can measure their activity. And this is the same type of data from flies. And so here is a normal fruit fly. You can see they have this characteristic circadian behavior with a period of about 24 hours. And so Ron Konopka suggested that they could do a genetic screen by making mutant fruit flies and see if they could affect their behavioral rhythms by altering their genetics. And that's what they did. And they were able to find three genetic mutations in fruit flies that altered their circadian behavioral patterns. They identified one single gene mutation that made the flies have no rhythms at all. They also identified mutations that either had a shorter period of behavioral rhythms or a longer period of behavioral rhythms. And this was actually the first demonstration that genes can influence behavior. So it was exciting not only for circadian biologists, but for biologists in general, really to show that a gene can influence behavior. And it was possible to do that because circadian rhythms are so easily quantifiable. Now, this discovery by Ron Konopka and Seymour Benzer actually led to the work that was awarded with the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine last year, in which these three biologists, Jeff Hall and Michael Rosbach, were at Brandeis University, and Michael Young at the Rockefeller University in New York City. They used the mutant fruit flies that Konopka and Benzer had isolated to actually identify what is the gene that's responsible for driving these rhythms in behavior. And they all did this at the same time. They were competing, racing to see who could figure it out first, and they basically all figured it out at the same time and published three papers in 1984 that all of the mutants that had been found by Konopka and Benzer were due to mutations in the same gene, which they named period or PER. So period because it changed the period of the fly's rhythmic behaviors. And then some people still argued, oh, okay, maybe genes can influence behavior in flies, but no way, not in mammals, not in people. And Joe Takahashi was then at Northwestern University in Chicago, and he did a similar study in mice and isolated a different gene that he named clock that also altered the behavioral rhythms in mice. And this is just some of his data shown here with the recording of mice and running wheels. Okay, so now they know genes can influence circadian behavioral rhythms in flies and in mice, and they know some of the proteins, some of the genes that contribute to that. And then over the next couple of decades, other people determined other genes that were involved. They found that the PER gene in flies is also present in mammals and contributes to circadian rhythms. And over time, they came to understand a mechanism, you know, by which circadian clocks are composed. And I'm going to take you through that. And it's basically a negative feedback loop. So I'm going to try to give a couple of analogies to this to try to make it clear. So if you know anything about electrical circuits, this is a negative feedback loop in an electrical circuit that produces oscillations. So basically, a circadian clock needs to have an oscillation of about 24 hours. So it needs to be an oscillatory network. And in an electrical circuit, you make an oscillatory network by having an amplifier, so a positive signal, and then a 180-degree phase shift, which is basically a negative feedback loop, and that leads to these oscillations. And you can imagine basically any time you have one signal that turns on something else, and then, you know, so A turns on B, B turns off A, you'll get oscillations in the activity of A because it's turning itself off, basically. And in biology, you probably have heard of the central dogma of biology, by which genes are encoded in DNA, DNA is then transcribed into RNA, and RNA is turned into proteins, and then proteins are really the active factors. And to make a negative feedback loop with these kind of components, there are proteins that are transcription factors that are actually responsible for turning the gene into the RNA. And then there are other proteins that are called transcriptional repressors that turn off the transcription factors. So if you can have a positively active transcription factor that turns on a gene, including the genes for their own repressors, and that turns off the transcription factor again. So you can think of the transcription factor as a light switch, and a transcriptional repressor turns it off. So if you turn on this light switch, which makes the repressor that turns it back off, and then you get these oscillations in on and off patterns of the transcription factor. Another way to think, try to make, think of another analogy, which is maybe silly, but I really like cookies. So if you can think of the DNA as the recipe, and you use the recipe as the instructions for how to make your cookies, and then the chef puts the ingredients together to make a batter, that's like the RNA, and then you have to turn the batter into the cookies, you have to bake them. And then the feedback is you taste the cookies, they're good, or no, they really need more salt or more chocolate or whatever. That feeds back and you do the circuit over again. It's maybe silly, but anyway. All right, so in the circadian clock, this is basically how it works. It's a negative feedback loop. So there are transcription factors. The clock protein, the one that was identified in the genetic screen in mice, is part of a transcription factor complex that turns on thousands of genes, including their own repressors, which includes the PER gene that was found in fruit flies, and another partner of PER called CRY, or cryptochrome, which is what we study in my lab, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it. And so these two work together to inhibit the activity of clock and BML1, and this creates a negative feedback loop. So clock and BML1 turn on PER and CRY along with many other genes, and that feeds back to turn off clock and BML, so the cycle starts again. Okay. So now, once all of these components of circadian clocks were identified in our little timeline in the history of circadian biology, so first the components were identified, then they tried to understand how they fit together to make this negative feedback loop that drives oscillations. But now the question then became, okay, what else do these do? And how can we use the understanding of how they're made up to understand how they work and to look more at where they're located in the body and things like that? So at that point, several different labs use the identity of these components to make tools that would allow them to observe circadian rhythms in animals in real time. And one of the tools that they used was actually taking proteins, so proteins that are naturally occurring that emit light, to allow them to watch circadian rhythms in real time in animals. So this is a picture. I was looking for pictures of fireflies because one of the so-called reporter genes that we use a lot is the luciferase that produces light in fireflies. And this is a picture from a blog, which then I started reading, which was really interesting. It's called Pinoy Transplant. It's a MD from the Philippines who moved to Iowa and really likes fireflies. So anyway, credit for the picture to him. But anyway, so fireflies produce light with it, and the light that fireflies produce comes from a protein that looks like, oh, that doesn't look very good. But anyway, this is a magnified view of the protein called luciferase that produces the light in the firefly here. This is about 100,000 fold magnification of the protein, and this is determined by the method that I mentioned earlier of X-ray crystallography. So this is one of the proteins that we can use in biology to enable us to watch and see what's happening with a protein of interest in real time. Another so-called reporter protein comes from jellyfish. So this is another one of these marine organisms I mentioned. Some of them produce light as camouflage. And this jellyfish produces a protein called green fluorescent protein that allows it to produce light. So we can use these as tools in biology to allow us to watch what's happening in proteins that we're interested in. And these tools were used by circadian biologists to look at where the PER protein is going at different times of day in different cells. And here's an example. This is a picture of a fruit fly in which scientists from Steve Kay's lab introduced the green fluorescent protein under the control of the transcriptional elements that control the expression of the PER gene. So the PER gene is the fruit fly gene that was identified by the three Nobel Prize winning groups to be responsible for circadian rhythms and behavior. And Steve Kay put the green fluorescent protein into the location in the DNA where PER is normally expressed. And that allowed them to see that fruit flies express green fluorescent protein all over their body. So not only in the place where in the brain that drives these behavioral rhythms, but actually everywhere throughout the body. And it's rhythmically expressed. So this is data from different parts of the fly, the antenna, the leg, the wing. And you can see they're recording the intensity of the green light that's produced from the protein. And it's exhibiting these daily rhythms in expression throughout the day all over the fly's body. Similarly, the firefly luciferase protein was introduced into mice connected to the PER2 protein in mice. And similarly, they found that the expression of this PER2 luciferase reporter exhibited circadian rhythms of expression all over the body. So the SCN is the region in the brain that drives the behavioral rhythms, but they also saw rhythms in PER2 luciferase expression in the lung, in the liver, in every tissue that they looked at. So this was really a huge surprise at the time. These clocks are not only present in the brain where they would be driving behavioral rhythms, but really everywhere, suggesting that there are clocks in every cell in your body that are keeping track of the time of day. Okay. So that suggests that pretty much all aspects of biology could be regulated by the time of day, which begs many different questions, and especially to me, you know, what are they doing in all those other places, and how can we use our understanding of that to understand biology better? And this is just this is some data from a study that I did almost 10 years ago. That was trying to ask, you know, how does the biology of the liver change at different times of day? And this is called a Western blot. It's another way of measuring protein. So when we don't have a fluorescent protein to look at, we can actually detect specific proteins using antibodies. And what I'm showing here, so in each one of these horizontal rectangles, each of these sort of lanes where there's a number, it's representing a liver at a specific time of day. The times of day are here. This is the hours after the lights come on in the morning. So that's shown here with the yellow and the black are just showing you the day and the night. And the point here is that if you look at different times of day, the protein composition of the liver is very different. So you don't need to worry about the specifics, but for example, this protein here is the CRY and the PER proteins, and you can see that their levels are much higher during the night. But this other protein that's called reverb alpha, which you don't have to worry about the specifics, but it's much higher during the day. So the bottom line is just that the composition of your liver is different at different times of day. So that suggests that its physiology could be different at different times of day. And this is data from one of these studies, which was repeated by many different groups. And they're showing gene expression of the whole genome and just looking at how much of it is regulated by the time of day. And basically all of these studies showed that about 10% of your genes are expressed differently at different times of day. And here each horizontal line represents a single gene, and the coloring represents the level of its expression. So the bright colors represent a high level of expression, and the dark colors represent a low level of expression. And this data is showing these expression patterns for a few thousand genes, or about 10% of the genome. And you can basically just see that there are rhythms in the patterns of expression. And they're affected by the time of day. And other groups later showed that the specific genes that are transcribed with a circadian rhythm in different organs depends on the organ. So there's a very small number of genes that are rhythmic everywhere, but a very large number of genes that are rhythmic in every tissue. And this is just sort of, these circles are showing the overlap of which specific genes are expressed rhythmically in different places. So the blue circle represents the 3,000 or so genes that are expressed rhythmically in the liver. And then these red circles represent the genes that are rhythmically expressed in these other tissues. And you can see that the overlap is relatively small. So which genes are rhythmically expressed depends on the organ, suggesting that it has something more to do with their specific function rather than a general response to the time of day. And one of the things that was observed by the people who did these studies is that genes that are important for metabolism are more likely to be rhythmically expressed, suggesting that circadian clocks outside of the brain are probably important for regulating metabolism. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about a study that I did to ask what, as I mentioned before, what is the circadian clock in the liver doing specifically, and how do we answer that question? Okay, so as I mentioned, there's a clock in the brain in a specific region of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or SCN. That's the so-called master pacemaker. Its timing is set by sunlight, and it drives these rhythms in activity patterns. But because it's driving rhythms in behavior, not only does that control when you sleep, but it also controls when you eat. Okay? And so the times when you eat are also determined by this clock. And I mentioned that there are clocks present in all these other locations, but and at first it was thought that the timing of those clocks would be set by the SCN clock. But what's been shown now is that they're actually set by the time of feeding. So they're indirectly determined by the timing of the SCN clock, because the SCN clock determines when the animals eat. But if you only give them food at a specific time of day and you can move that around, it turns out that it's actually when the animals eat that determines the set time of their other clocks in places like the liver and the muscle. Again, suggesting that their function is important for predicting times of different metabolic demands, and that the clocks in those tissues are important for adjusting metabolism to meet different needs at different times of day. So getting back to this question of homeostasis, again, it suggests that those clocks in places like the liver and the muscle are allowing the organism to enable homeostasis by allowing them to predict when there will be different metabolic demands and optimizing their physiology to account for that. Okay, so what is the function of the clocks in all these other places? We have a lot of reason to think that it might have something to do with metabolism, or it might at least be important for metabolism. So the question is, do these clocks alter metabolism? Does having a clock in your liver and your muscle and your pancreas protect you from metabolic disease like diabetes? And one of the first ways that we studied this was work that I did just after I finished my PhD at when I was working with Chuck Weitz at Harvard Medical School. What we did was we generated a mouse that has clocks everywhere except in the liver. So they have normal behavioral patterns, normal activity, normal feeding, but they just don't have a clock in their liver. And they're normal in every other way. And again, this is the negative feedback loop that drives the function of the clock in mammals. And the way we made these mice was by deleting the gene BMAL1, which is a partner of the clock protein to turn on transcription, only in the liver. And if anyone wants, I can talk to you more about later about how we did that. But basically, we delete that gene only in the liver. And what we found, we looked at their blood glucose, because one of the major metabolic functions of the liver is to produce sugar, blood sugar, glucose, in times of need. So if your blood sugar is low, your liver produces more glucose to replace it. So we measured the blood sugar at different times of day in these mice, and what we found is that they're unable to maintain glucose homeostasis during the day. And you can see that at nighttime, when the mice are eating, their blood sugar is normal. But during the day, when the mice are resting, their blood sugar drops. And this suggests that having a clock in the liver allows them to predict this time of daily fasting and compensate for the lack of sugar coming from food by producing more of it in the liver. So here, this is in cartoon form. Normally, mice have a rhythm in feeding behavior, so they're getting different amounts of sugar at different times of day. And the liver clock basically counteracts that rhythm by producing blood sugar with the opposite phase, leading to allowing homeostasis of blood sugar by sort of having two compensatory rhythms. And here I'm just going to mention some work from Sachin Panda's lab at the Salk Institute. Finding that the time of eating sets circadian clocks and that allows them to predict times of fasting suggests that the timing of when you eat might be really important. And Sachin Panda's lab has done a number of studies that have demonstrated that this is really true. One of the things they did is they put mice on a high-fat diet, and they either allow them to eat it whenever they want, or they only allow them to have access to the exact same food, but only during a 12-hour window. So they're still going to have this daily fasting period. And what they found is that even though the mice eat the exact same amount of the exact same food, the ones that can only eat it during a defined 12-hour window are much healthier. They gain less weight, and they have fewer other metabolic problems from this high-fat diet. So the timing of when you eat is actually really important. Okay, so there have been a lot of epidemiological studies that have shown, you're probably aware, that many metabolic diseases are increasing in the U.S. at least, and in the developed world. But also other health problems are enhanced by having disrupted circadian rhythm. So people who do rotating shift work, for example, are chronically disrupting their circadian rhythms. And that leads to several negative health consequences, including metabolic disease, but also cancer and other pathologies. So one of the things that I'm really interested in my lab is trying to understand why that's the case. And if we can understand some of the reasons behind this, can we improve our recommendations for lifestyle or for treatments? And I think I mentioned before that the proteins that we're really most focused on in my lab are these cry proteins. They're partners of the PIRR proteins that feed back to turn off clock and BMAL1. So they're the negative part of this negative feedback loop. And so one of the things we got really interested in is how might these proteins be acting as outputs to this, in addition to providing negative feedback in the clock, do they also influence other pathways outside of the clock in a time of day dependent manner? So for example, they turn off the gene expression that's driven by clock and BMAL1, but might they also turn off gene expression through other factors that turn on genetic pathways? And if so, that would lead to rhythmic activity of those other transcription factors as well. And to make a long story short, we've found that they do, that they influence transcription in several other pathways. And one of the major ones that we've looked at is a large family of transcription factors that are really important for regulating metabolism in mammals called nuclear hormone receptors. Now, if you first hear nuclear hormone receptor, what is that? It sounds strange. But the nuclear part just tells us that these are proteins that are present within the nucleus of cells. And they recognize specific sequences in DNA, and they sit down on DNA and either turn the gene on or turn the gene off, depending on which other proteins are associated with them. And so there are proteins called co-repressors that turn off the genes that are bound by these nuclear hormone receptors when they're in the off state. But then if they're exposed to hormones, that changes the shape of the nuclear hormone receptor and allows them to interact with a co-activator instead of a co-repressor. So this is like turning on the transcription factor. So when it's associated with this repressor protein, the gene is turned off. And then when it is exposed to the hormone, it gets turned on by being associated with a different protein that actually activates the expression of the gene it's bound to. And what we found is that the cry protein is one it can act as one of these co-repressors for nuclear hormone receptors and keep them turned off. Nuclear hormone receptors, there are 48 of them in humans. They respond to things that you've heard of, like testosterone, estrogen, glucocorticoids, which are stress hormones, vitamin D and other vitamins, and also fatty acids, and even xenobiotics, which basically refers to any chemical that's not produced inside your body. So lots of drugs and environmental toxins would activate these nuclear hormone receptors. And I'm just going to very briefly mention that cryptochromes interact with several of these nuclear hormone receptors, and we've studied a few of them in my lab. This PPAR family of nuclear receptors is important for regulating exercise, and I'm going to show you a little, just one slide of data about how cryptochromes regulate those receptors. They also regulate the response to stress hormones by interacting with the glucocorticoid receptor, and they also regulate drug transport and metabolism by interacting with these xenobiotic receptors. So first, I'm just going to tell you we've looked at the effect of deleting cryptochromes on exercise physiology because we had seen that they can interact with this receptor called PPAR-delta that's activated by fatty acids. And PPAR-delta is known to be really important for enhancing exercise capacity. So we decided to look at what happens to exercise capacity in mice that don't have cryptochromes, because you would expect that this receptor would be more active since they're missing this protein that turns it off. And these are some of the people who've worked on this in my lab. Sabine Jordan was a postdoc who really started this project, and she showed that mice that don't have cryptochromes actually do have increased exercise capacity, so they can run faster and farther than mice that don't, have cryptochromes. Megan Vaughn and Drew Duglin are in the lab now who are kind of following up on this work. Megan's really interested in understanding more why this is true, and Drew is really interested in understanding how the time of day affects exercise physiology. And I'm just showing a little bit of data here that he's shown in mice that are not trained at all, their exercise capacity is not influenced by the time of day, but if you expose them to exercise training for a couple of months, their exercise capacity is more greatly enhanced at the same time of day that they were trained at. So if they're trained during the night, they're able to run faster and farther at night afterwards. And he's trying to understand how the cryoproteins play into that. I mentioned also that the cryoproteins can repress the glucocorticoid receptor, which responds to stress hormones. And the stress hormone, cortisol, is something that itself exhibits a very strong daily rhythm. And this is data from people. You can see that it's very different at different times of day. And in fact, it really peaks in the morning when you wake up. So this is kind of part of your get-up-and-go mechanism. It's also involved in fight-or-flight response, but it basically gives you an acute burst of energy. And we know that cryptochromes can inhibit the glucocorticoid receptor, and we know that the glucocorticoid receptor has, the glucocorticoid hormone normally has these strong rhythms. And it has many different physiological effects. One of the first that was really well understood was its role in suppressing inflammation. So the cortisol was actually discovered in people who were studying by people who were studying rheumatoid arthritis, and they found that you could administer glucocorticoids to people with rheumatoid arthritis and improve their symptoms. And so synthetic glucocorticoids are widely used as treatments for inflammation, so things like asthma and arthritis. But because glucocorticoids have all these different physiological effects, the drugs have some unwanted side effects, including high blood sugar. And we wanted to know whether the role of the circadian clock in the liver in this pathway could allow us to influence to reduce the negative side effects of glucocorticoid treatments. And so when I was working with Ron Evans at the Salk Institute, we actually showed that simply by treating mice at different times of day with this synthetic glucocorticoid dexamethasone, you could reduce the unwanted metabolic consequences of chronic glucocorticoid treatment. So normally, mice, just like humans, if they're exposed to chronic treatment with glucocorticoids, get this high blood sugar. It's shown here in red when they're treated during the day. Mice treated instead at night for the same chronic dose at 8 weeks had a much less severe hyperglycemic response to the drug. These findings have also contributed to some work that was done here at Scripps. looking for, these are small molecule compounds, chemicals, that were designed to stabilize the cry proteins. And they found that you could actually use these drugs to reduce hyperglycemia as well. And I also mentioned that cryptochromes can suppress the action of pathways that are involved in drug transport and metabolism. So that suggests that the time of day of administration of many different drugs could actually influence their effectiveness or their toxicity. And this is just a little bit of data from a study we did with a widely used diabetes drug to ask whether the time of day of treating mice with this drug could influence its effect on blood glucose. And again, here we were able to see that reducing blood sugar in response to this drug was much more effective at night than during the day. And we're still trying to understand more about the mechanisms by which this happens. I want to just mention a note about balancing work and family. This is something I get asked about a lot, and like to show it when I'm talking to groups that are maybe thinking about a career in science. And I love this job. It's really fun. It is hard, no doubt. But I think that's true with almost any really rewarding job. So here, this is a picture of me with my daughter about a week after she was born, submitting this paper on our study of glucocorticoids. And everything went well. Paper got published. My daughter is now 7, happy and healthy. And along those lines, I like to show this data for anyone who has a child, which hopefully none of you have done yet, but if and when you do, be prepared for a couple of months of no circadian rhythms in the baby, which is very tiring for the parents. You can all go home and apologize to your parents for this, the few months that they handled this for you. And eventually, so the circadian system develops in people after birth, and it takes a few months until they finally develop these sort of regular patterns of sleep and wake. Okay, so I'm going to just briefly mention that we're also interested in how circadian clocks and the cry proteins in particular influence increased cancer risk in response to circadian disruption. This is some data looking at cells. The purple staining are where the cells are, and you can grow cells in a dish. And the wild type here means the normal cells. And here we have cells that don't have cry2, and here are cells that don't have cry1. So in mammals, there are two cryptochromes, cry1 and cry2. And you can see that cells that don't have cry2, basically there are a lot more cells on all of these plates. And what we say is that they're more susceptible to transformation. So they're more susceptible to being able to grow under stressful conditions, which is one of the hallmarks of progression to forming a tumor. And these are just different stimuli that can enhance tumor formation, and you can see that the normal cells also have increased growth in these conditions, but the cells that don't have cry2 have a much more severe response. And so that suggests that cells that don't have cry2 would be more at risk for forming a cancer. And Anne-Laure Hubert was a postdoc who did this work. And what she found, to make a long story short, is that this is, again, one of those Western blots like I showed, where each one of these black rectangles, we call them a band, represents the level of a protein. And in this case, it's the level of a protein called c-MYC, which is one of the most frequently mutated genes in human cancer. And what Anne-Laure found is that the c-MYC protein is much higher in cells that don't have cry2. And it took a couple of years to figure out why that was the case. But what Anne-Laure discovered is that the cry2 protein actually targets c-MYC for degradation. So in cells, proteins are degraded by a machinery called the proteasome, and they're actually marked for degradation. They get targeted to the proteasome by being modified by a small protein called ubiquitin. So what Anne-Laure discovered is that cry2 is responsible for adding this little protein called ubiquitin. It's like a marker, a tag, onto c-MYC so that it can be degraded. And so cells that don't have cry2 have less of this mechanism, so they have more of the c-MYC protein. So that suggests that losing or mutating Cry2 would leave cells and people more susceptible to cancer. And we collaborated with a bioinformatician next door at the Genomic Institute of the Novartis Research Foundation, who looked at human cancer data and found that indeed the expression of Cry2, shown in the cancer in red here, so all this data is looking at the level of expression of Cry2, is lower in tumor samples compared to normal samples from the same organs in many different cancer types. And we're still trying to understand whether this is really relevant in humans. Can the mutation of Cry2 actually play a causative role in forming cancer? And can we harness that knowledge for prevention or treatment? So I'm just briefly going to mention some of the work that's ongoing in the lab right now. Marie Parriot is a postdoc who is studying the role of Cry2 in lung cancer. And Alana, who introduced me this morning, is studying... She has identified several mutations in Cry2 that are found in human tumors, and she's trying to understand what those mutations do to the Cry2 protein function and whether they can actually play a causative role in the formation of those cancers and whether we can use some of the drugs that I mentioned that target Cry2 as actually for treatment in cancers of those types. So I'm just going to give a brief summary of what I told you. Circadian clocks are present in pretty much all organisms that have been studied. They function as a negative feedback loop of these transcription factors, clock and BML1, that activate their own repressors that allows for oscillations. And they regulate many different aspects of physiology, like glucose production, drug metabolism, exercise physiology. And they also influence, they turn transcription factors off by stimulating their degradation, and including the protein c-MYC that's very influential in tumor formation. So with that, I want to thank the people in my lab and many people that we've collaborated with, and the Scripps Research Institute that gave me this great opportunity to start a lab, and all these different funding organizations. And finally recognize the people in the lab for being really wonderful colleagues. And I'd love to take any questions that you have.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.